Welcome to the Mushrooms Apprentice. My guest today is Alana Moore. Alana is an Irish geomancer who assesses the invisible dimensions of life and land. She has been teaching across Australia, New Zealand, Asia, and Europe since the early 1980s, gaining a wealth of insight into subtle energies, earth mysteries, nature spirits, the folklore of traditional interactions with them, and the imperative of maintaining harmony with the other worlds. Alana has authored geomantically inspired educational material, books, articles, documentary films, and songs, all of which can be found on her website, geomantica.com. Alana is also a keen gardener, writer, poet, singer, teacher, and filmmaker. Originally from Australia, she currently lives in rural Ireland. Her latest book, Fairy Haunts of Ireland, is available on Amazon, and I highly recommend that book. So welcome, Alana. It is a pleasure to have you here.
Thank you, Shona. That was a beautiful introduction.
Okay. Good. Well, it's right to justice. Where justice is due. So I would love for you to just talk about first, how did you even find your way into geomancy? Because by kind of mainstream mindset, it is highly unusual. But of course, we know it's old can be. So let's hear it.
Yeah. Well, I suppose it goes back to before I discovered the dowsers in London. I was living in London in the 70s. And I had my one and only child there, and I didn't have family. They're all back in Australia. And so it was a bit of touch and go, work it out as you go, experiment with this baby. What do you do with them? So I had to bring my intuition into gear very quickly to help me to, when they cry and they can't express themselves, and you've got to work it out. No wonder they say that intuition is very much the domain of women, which is not exclusive, but you know, the women need it more perhaps because of these things. So when he was only a few months old, he used to cry a lot, and I couldn't work out any logical reason for it. But then I'd read in a British Dowsing Society journal about the influence of energy lines. It could be artificial, it could be of the earth, but just flows of energy which are a bit intense. And they can upset health or well-being in some way. And so I thought, well, I'll give it a go. And just a matter of trying to move the bed, the cot, and put it in different positions, won't hurt, give it a try. And he did stop crying. So whether it was coincidence or not doesn't really matter, but it launched me into feeling confident to continue exploring and finding out the influence of the energies of the earth on people, which is basically what geomancy is, that we're trying to navigate around that. And the scientists these days sometimes talk about geobiology, which is just a sort of fancy scientific term for that same thing, what we used to call geomancy, without the more mythic sort of elements to it. So that, you could say, the average geomancer, you know, that rare occupation, their bread and butter work would be just to help people navigate a safe place to sleep in their homes, might have to move the bed, might have to do some corrective work on the energies if they're not suitable for human health. Because I don't talk about good and bad energies. It's all relative. You could have a very so-called good energy, but if you were sleeping on it, it wouldn't have a good effect. So any strong energy you really need to try and avoid, especially in the sleeping spot, to have, you know, restorative sleeping. Mm.
So when did you start? Mm. Is that when you started with a pendulum, or how did your dowsing?
Yeah, so somebody showed me the pendulum when I lived in London, as I said, and I was so blown away by it that it was responding to my intuition. And until that point, for as long as I could remember since childhood, I'd been aware of spirits coming and, you know, waking me up in the night, or the influence of the invisible world would occasionally come to me, as it does to children, but they don't usually express it or think about it after they've grown up. But the real impetus was to join the British Society of Dowsers and get the journals. And I couldn't go to the meetings and meet the people because I had a baby. And then I left not long after. But I took that experience and the great learning I got from reading the articles. Arrived back in Sydney, and I was super excited about dowsing, that the fact that it could harness my intuitive faculties in a controlled manner. So instead of just having some vague sense of disquiet or whatever, finally you could put a bit of a handle on it. You could ask questions and have a controlled approach to understanding these things. So all the excitement, I took back to Sydney. I managed to meet, and this is before the internet, I managed to meet people also interested. And in fact, I even started writing, because I've always been a writer and creative person. Started writing a little magazine and had it in some theosophical bookshops and things like that. And someone said to me, you won't get rich making these magazines. I said, yeah, well, that's not the purpose, is it? But I was networking and, you know, I did get 150 subscribers to that magazine. But anyway, I met this a woman, an old elderly lady, and she was a great dowser. And she'd had a lot of students had been through her training. And she said, Alana, we need a dowsing society. I want you to be the secretary. I don't think I was a good secretary material, but I did my best and I helped to start the society. And of course, then as the secretary, I would receive all the publications from around the world. I'd get people translating the German one for me and this and that. And they're so way advanced in the dowsing, you know, the European dowsers, that it was just mind-blowing stuff. And so then I'd put snippets in my magazine about what other people are doing in the rest of the world. And that society is still going strong. And I'm happy to say I'll be going back there at the end of the year for their 40th anniversary, which is fantastic, at the end of the year. So we'll be celebrating. Yeah. You see, I was only 25 when I was doing it. And that woman, she picked me well. She thought, yeah, pick a young person to do it, to start the society.
Yeah. Well, it's all I mean you were chosen in a sense, you know.
Yeah, I was chosen.
Yeah, for this whole path.
And so since then I've been a speaker, of course, for them in Sydney, but I haven't lived in Sydney. That's where I'm from, but I chose not to live there because it's too overstimulating in the city. I'm too sensitive to live in the city. I've always lived in the country by choice. Just in a little village now, but it's a sleepy town. And so I've also been a speaker at other conferences, at, you know, British Dowsers and other places. And so you get to meet the people who are obsessed with the subject, as I am, and you learn a lot. When you're a teacher, you do learn a lot from the act of teaching and research and everything. So it's just been such an interesting life, and there's no end to it. The magic of discovering of what is out there in the invisible world is just an unending revelation of excitement and mystery and revealed.
Yes, yes. Could you talk about these lines of invisible energy that cover our planet? I mean, aren't they really like the meridians of our own body in a sense?
That's one aspect, one type of line. You could say there's a lot of different varieties of them. So when people picture a grid pattern around the Earth, well, yeah, it's like a world. There is a world grid or a universal grid. There are several grids going different directions, but they're like a three-dimensional grid, just the way the energy moves in the universe. So then we've kind of evolved with that. But then we get these lines of energy that are not associated with the grids as well, which have been called ley lines. However, that's a concept which has come from a thing of physical alignment. So it's not necessarily an energetic thing. And when people say, oh, you're looking for ley lines, I'd say, well, I'd look for energy lays, and just to make it clear that I'm not talking about an alignment between a church and a standing stone sort of thing. But often there'll be a parallel that there will be an alignment of buildings or sacred structures, and there'll also be an energy line associated, so that can happen. But then I'm more interested in the energies of the earth, which are the yin energies, and they've come up out of the ground, and they don't go in straight lines at all. They go in curving, meandering lines, and they're slow and they distribute the beautiful energy of the earth to the landscape. The Chinese call them dragon lines. The Irish call them fairy lines. Everyone has a different name. But the big difference with these so-called ley lines is that they're not straight. They curve. So they're shaped like a serpent. And if you're an Australian Aboriginal, you might think of it as a serpent line. So the old serpent pops up everywhere because it is part of the fundamental basis of all understanding about energy, sacred energy movement. I think that these lines tend to sort of flow in a sort of serpentine manner, actually like a toroidal vortex is spinning around. For some dowsers that can see the energies, but I can see some things, but not them.
That is so interesting. So when you're dowsing, then are how can you tell the difference between, I mean, I assume you're asking, right, between these?
Yes. I suppose when you're dowsing, you really have to have a concept of what you're looking for first. It's like anything in the world. If you don't have a concept of it, you almost don't see it because you don't know anything about it. It doesn't register. So you need to have a mental framework. And then you can say, all right, is that a this, is that a this, that, or the other? And ask those questions, and then you get the yes and the no answers from the dowsing. But then it becomes, the more you do the dowsing, the more it gets inside of you that you don't need the dowsing tool. And you just get that answer in your gut feeling, or I just get a knowing in my mind. And just, you learn to trust, because most people would not trust their intuition because they don't have the training that. They have the emphasis always on the logical side in the education system. So developing the confidence is what I like to help people when I'm teaching. And it's a self-development thing. You do it on your own. But when you're in a class for a day, it's great. You get a bit of a kickstart. And the energy of the group helps you on the way. So there's been some wonderful revelations for people, and I love to see their eyes lighting up when the thing spins around. It's like, oh, wow. It's so exciting for me too.
Yes.
Oh, it's a whole new world.
That's exactly. It's a whole new world. And yet it is our world that we live in.
Yeah. Like one woman said, oh, I'm going to see the world through new eyes now. That's great.
So I just want to clarify. So ley lines created then between two sacred, for lack of a better word, so two very old sites?
Well, not consciously. I'd say it's an artifact of the human interaction with the site. It's about people thinking about those sites. Yeah, and it all feeds into those energies. It's about people moving between those sites. They leave residual energies, and all these energies sort of build up and mix together, and which is what a sacred site is. It's a mixture of our energy and the site and the beings that come to it and the activities of the people there, you know, combination. But they are, the energy layers are found typically in the Europe anyway, I don't know about America, found associated with human settlements. But whereas back in Australia, you see, I've got a more sort of raw approach to it because they didn't have buildings, you know, and they didn't have temples, you know, they had places, but the energy layers there, I found they're more associated with the mountaintops because they're a yang energy, so there might be a line that connects to mountaintop to mountaintop, so it's more of a natural sort of a ley line, and that people have nothing to do with that, but who knows, there's no records, we can't prove any of this.
So I mean, I'll ask maybe some possibly stupid questions, but I'm curious about this thing. Okay. So what are the Michael and Mary lines through Europe?
Yeah,
so
the, those are dragon lines, I think.
They are.
Well, what the Chinese would call dragon lines, because they have this curving form. So where those curving lines crossed, they found the sacred sites were placed there. But I haven't personally doused those, but I have met Hamish Miller and he gave me a big hug. So that's all I know. I read his book. He's a nice guy. He came late from Cornwall before he died, obviously, to a conference that I was a speaker at, and I was talking about Australian Aboriginal stuff, and he loved it so much. That's when he gave me the hug, and he said it was worth the trip from Cornwall just to hear all that. So that was lovely.
Oh, wonderful. Well,
yeah.
can we talk a bit about that? So how does that work in Australia in terms of the dowsing? What is the approach? I would think the Aboriginals, like you said, they don't use probably a pendulum or dowsing rods, do they? Do they use
No, it? Someone suggested their feet are dowsing tools.
That makes sense.
I don't know. They could be. I think they just have traditionally have a good sense of intuition, you know, like the travellers or the gypsies, you know, traditionally have good intuition, or the Irish. They talk about the luck of the Irish, you know, that's a sign of good intuition when you're just in the right place at the right time rather than the wrong place at the wrong time. Of course, we just had St. Patrick's Day, so there's a bit of luck. Even the bus has got green shamrocks on it, and it says lucky on the bus. So something to do with St. Patrick.
Okay. Well, so the Aboriginal people in Australia, this is just comes naturally to them, obviously, as well.
Yeah, I'd say so. And because there's a tradition of it. So, for instance, I had a partner for a while who was incredibly clairvoyant, much more than I am. I am a little bit, but he helped me to develop in that way, the seeing aspect, and also the confidence in dowsing the nature spirits, because he could see them. And I'd say, oh, well, I can pick up on their energy, because dowsing is a feeling thing. And so I developed confidence there. But he used to go out and visit these Aboriginal communities and live near them. And often it was quite hard to get in there. Like, it's not a place for white people to be hanging around, and certainly not tourists. So he used to get a lift in with a local teacher and just sort of hang out for occasionally at this Papunya, this famous, I think it was at Papunya, famous arts community near Alice Springs, where the highly sought after artwork they do. And when he arrived there, he saw this huge spirit with lots of little ones on a ridge near the little village. And he's met some elders after that. And he said, oh, you know, hello, I'm Billy. And, oh, and by the way, would you mind telling me, do you know anything about the spirit that I've seen there, up there, and the little spirits? And they were like, wow, this guy can see our spirits, because, you know, they lived in their village, and they, of course, they knew them. They said, yes, that's the female spirit that looks after the spirits of the babies that die on the community. And that's what he'd seen. She was caring for the little babies. Yeah, the spirits of them. So I thought that must have been a very beautiful thing to see. Yeah. Because in the Irish tradition, if you, in the past, people used to say, or have the belief, which was then borne out by what people saw, they'd say that if you died young, ahead of your time, not old, that the fairies would look after you, or when I say fairies, nature spirits would look after you. Because then seers would see a bunch of fairies, and they'd see the dead uncle or whatever in amongst them. And that then people would interpret that in strange ways, and they'd say, oh, well, fairies are just dead people. But no, it's not. That's not the case. It's the nature spirits would take those spirits and care for them. I don't know what happened to them then, but they were the fairy stories that always say, like, they're not interested in you if you're old, because if you're old, you can just go off somewhere else. they would take the younger spirits. So that's what Billy saw, was the female spirit tending the little baby spirits. And actually, because he went there on a regular basis, they used to call him the spirit man. And this is a white man being called the spirit man by the black people, which was amazing. And then there was another very famous Aboriginal that Billy went to meet. And that guy was slamming his fist on the table saying, you've got to tell our young people what you see, because they don't listen to us old people. Tell them about those spirits, and tell them. Like everywhere, you know, the young rejecting the culture. Another guy saying, yeah, you got to talk that up. Tell other people about it. So I suppose I'm following in that path, because I'm telling people about spirits and the ins and outs, because I've not only had my own insights, and I've had the pleasure and privilege of spending time with other very clairvoyant or in the know people. And then I've compared that with folklore, tradition, and history, and whatever's been written up. So I put on my hat of a journalist when I'm doing the book. I don't want to just put my impression. I'm interested in what is the sort of consensus of what's feeling about this, that, and the other. So I just like writing books, because I think there's a lot of biased information out there, and particularly in Ireland, where anything to do with the gods and goddesses of Ireland are not celebrated like the Greeks make a big thing about the gods of Olympus, and it probably gets the tourists in. No, they're continually trying to blank them out of history in Ireland. So they don't, they're embarrassed by them. So I've come along with fresh eyes from another country and trying to look at it from a different perspective, and write and give them what they're worth in terms of writing about them, because it's a fascinating story of the historical spiritual history of the Irish.
Yes, well, I think this information is dearly needed now, because I feel like people are essentially lost in the machine, if you will. And now the technology, I wrote in my book about just how, we had the industrial age, and that really seduced people away from their traditions. It was astonishing. And now this is even worse, because people's brains are changing. And of course, the energies, which I also want you to talk about in terms of the effects of, the electromagnetic artificial energies. But this piece about, it's almost like the Pied Piper just seducing people away from their folk soul, from the knowledge of their people. And you've done such a beautiful job in just raising awareness about that. Yeah, thank you. Yeah.
I think people's head are filled with clutter, too much clutter. It's like I got rid of my television over 10 years ago. I have not missed it, and my brain is, free enough to be able to write books, and also to have impressions about the invisible world, because often I need to be doing nothing, and that's when I get impressions. If you try and go, I must see something, it's not going to happen.
I'm laughing because I know what you're talking about, because when I call them the beings speak to me, it's either when I'm deep in a mushroom journey, or when I'm kind of about to fall asleep or about to wake up in that kind of liminal state, or if I'm on an airplane, because I'm sitting still, I'm kind of daydreaming, or on my morning walks. Yes. But beyond that, I'm like, go, 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 do, do, do. And they're like, we can't get much wise here.
I know. And this is what people are not sitting still for long enough, and they're not keeping their mind clear to appreciate what's subtle and good out there. They're just constantly putting rubbish into their head.
Yes, well, it's stimuli.
Yeah, overstimulated, yes. Yeah, see, for instance, good example was last year, and I'm going next year, this year, there was a festival put on by the people who do the Nexus magazine in Germany, and that's the magazine started in Australia. I know the editor. So all these lectures were happening in German language, which I don't speak. But so I sat there not understanding a word at one of these lectures, but I was looking at this woman who was doing a healing thing on me. I just had to sit there and get some energy work thing done to me. And so my mind was just doing nothing for like 45 minutes. And then suddenly I realized that this beautiful healer woman had two enormous angels standing next to her, and then they started communicating with me. And it was like, wow, this doesn't normally happen, because I don't make it happen, you could say. Yeah, and they were saying, where do we do networking for her, and, can you help her? I said, well, I don't know, I might be able to. I published an article on my magazine for her. I don't know if it helped her, but I tried. A beautiful woman. And it was just gorgeous to communicate with these angels. They were huge. But that wouldn't have happened if I hadn't have been just doing nothing.
Yes. Well, my late teacher would call that shifting states of consciousness. You have to shift states of consciousness.
Yes.
Yeah.
But I suppose also if you there was a group of people who were probably like-minded, so there was probably special energies in the room. Who knows?
Yes. Yes. Sure. Yeah. Probably slightly raised vibration to that
yes.
field.
Yes.
Yeah, because groups of people have a field of energy around.
Yeah, and it's all sort of feeding into each other's. And yeah, so it was great, especially after the COVID years. It was so great to have this festival. I so enjoyed it, even though the language was a barrier. It was great. So I look forward to going back to that again.
I'll bet. Well,
yeah.
Let's go back to this, bringing back the old knowledge, if you will.
Yeah, exactly. So someone has written a review of my fairy book lately, and they made a very nice comment, and they said it was animism for the 21st century. And I thought, oh, I love that. I have to put that on the back cover.
Yes. Well, let's have you talk about that book, because that relates to the prior question. So, of course, Ireland is well known for the fairy haunts. And so let's have you talk about that.
Yeah. Well, it is, and yet when you hear the average person is not interested, you know, of course there's few interested, but not the average person, and but country people much more so, of course, more closer to the earth, not city people. That's the same everywhere, and they're so busy being modern here that they're not even very interested in history. And I'm fascinated by all the history all around me, particularly the Iron Age history. 2,000 years ago, you see it. You see the monuments from 2,000 years ago. It's incredible. But a lot of the places that are associated with people are now associated with fairies. So, for instance, they used to live surrounded by a circular bank wall, which had prickly bushes growing on top to keep the wolves out. So every night their little house was in the middle, and they'd bring the cows in and lock them in so the wolves didn't get them, or the sheep, goats. So when the people died and left, those circular banks, the houses melted because they were just made out of wood and they rotted, but the circular banks remained, and it was taboo to do anything. So even today, and then they were lived in until the medieval era, when the wolves became extinct about 1600. So some of them might be 2,000 years old, some might only be 500, 600 years old or whatever. But when people left, there was a taboo about touching them, never harvest, never take wood off them, firewood. And then they became called fairy forts because they were like protected areas, you know, like a national park is protected, probably full of nature spirits, because these fairy forts are now full of fairies and they know they're safe there. The farmer's not going to do anything. Sometimes they just keep it nice and tidy looking. Other ones are just totally wild. So when you see a circle, a wild looking circle of bushes and trees, that is you, and often on a hilltop, that usually signifies, you know, an old human settlement. But it's now probably the home of the local fairies, because it's the only wild place that they can find. And they're not very keen on ground that's been, you know, dug up and agricultural activities. They stick to the wild places, and there's no natural forests left in Ireland, so they had to go to places like that. So there's over 30,000 of those ring forts, so there's plenty of fairies there. Then there's more ancient monuments, which go back to even Neolithic times, so they might be 6,000 years old. Probably lots of fairies there too, but I haven't done an inventory, but I'm sure there's a lot out there. And then, of course, there's the natural features where they naturally live. So they are associated somewhat with human sites, but they're just part of nature. So you tend to find them, water spirits at water places. And I mean, it's the same everywhere. It's just that the Irish were good at talking about it and writing stories about it. And the Folklore Commission collected thousands and thousands of stories in the 1930s from school kids who went out and were told to get stories off the grandparents and the elders. Yeah, and it's a wonderful resource. So they say if you're into history, it's the local history that is the most truthful sort of history, because otherwise the national histories have been manipulated for political purposes usually. So anyone potentially could find fairies. They could look up this great treasury of folklore tales. It's all online now. A lot of them have been digitized, whereas before you'd have to go to the library and look at the microfiche collection. It was very old-fashioned technology, now digitized. So yeah, and you can look up your area and look at the map, see where the schools were, and they have all the stories from those schools. So potentially you could just find millions of fairies in the stories, in the traditions. So that's kind of special. In fact, that folklore commission collection is now registered under the UNESCO, you know, most amazing things. I don't know what it's called. It's got a UNESCO listing. It's on a par with the Book of Kells.
What?
So the Book of Kells has got the same UNESCO listing as the Folklore Commission stories that were collected. It's the value of the content that I think is, you know, I think it's more important than the Book of Kells myself, because it's the true traditions. And when they say fairy stories in Ireland, they're actually talking about eyewitness accounts. And the story might be, well, you know, my grandfather knew somebody's cousin's neighbor and they met the fairy and whatever. Or it was my mother's, you know, it's often it was the writer had seen it. And then then you'll read the same story, slight different versions from the nearby schools. And you think, oh, okay, so that was that local story verified by several people. And it's just amazing. It's a wonderful resource for writing books. So I'm having a great time. I was like going down the rabbit hole when I'm doing my research because I just love it. There's no end to it.
That's great. What's the name of that website, Alana?
Duchas.ie, Duchas, Irish word, Duchas.ie. Yeah, I put that in my fairy book.
Yeah, and
I was praising it in there because either you can see them, or you know, how do you find them? But actually, I teach people how to find them by the dowsing. And I think that's fairly unique, even though it's not difficult or anything. It's just a bit of it's breaking through this mental barrier that the Christianity put up there, I think, that people thought of it as something out there, something made up or whatever. But the fact that you can actually connect into their dimensional world, other dimensional world, I think is wonderful. And I love doing it. But I don't do it all the time because it's, you know, it's like going to another planet. It's not our planet. You know, we live in our world. They live in their nature spirit world. But then again, if I'm doing my professional dowsing job, it's often imperative that I do find out where they live, because, you know, someone might want to be building on the piece of land in the wrong place and upset them. So it's a tradition that there were fairy doctors in Ireland and they communicated with them and they would converse and find out whether the building site was correct or not, or it was in the way. And if it was on one of these lines of energy that they call fairy passes or fairy lines, they'd have obscure ways of describing them. They'd say, oh, that house is in the way. And they wouldn't never talk about fairies. That was considered impolite. It'd be like, you talk about them. Don't upset them. Because I suppose when you utter the name or something, you might be connecting in with them and they don't like that or something. But they were highly respectful, you could say. And trying not to be in the way was a good idea, because so many stories would say, what happens if you're in the way is, well, your cows would die, your family would die, everything wrong would happen.
And yeah, it was no joke.
Yeah, exactly. It was very serious consequences of putting your house or building in the wrong place. Yeah. Mm-hmm. So a modern geobiologist does something like that, but they're not normally working in the spirit world. But I like to look at all the influences in a site, and sometimes the nature spirit ones are more important than the energy lines. And this is what is something that's relatively new to the dowsing world. And it was back in 2003 that I introduced the concept of dowsing for nature spirits to the British Society of Dowsers at a conference. And I called it Deva dowsing, but it doesn't matter what you call it. Some people call it nature dowsing now. That was the first time it ever been talked about, because the history of the dowsers in the British dowsers was a society set up by ex-military people after some war, and they were interested in looking for landmines or something, so which is fine. But they weren't into fairies. And so since you'd never read anything in the journal about it. And then I sort of gave them this new concept of like, hey, there's other things you can look for when they have consciousness. And so now you can read about fairies in their magazine, and it's sort of okay now to talk about that. Yeah. And so it's been lovely. And then when I travel to different countries, I get different perspectives on it. So I often used to teach in Malaysia and have Chinese students, and like they go out every day and they light incense at the shrine of the air spirits and give offerings of fruit and water to the earth spirits in the earth spirit shrine every morning at my friend's place. And now his son has grown up and his son does it. It's intergenerational. Every building site in Malaysia, if they don't have a spirit shrine to appease the local spirits, the builders won't work. They say, oh no, you have to look after the fairies type of thing. Yeah, you have to honour the spirits. Spirits of place. And of course, it's officially a Muslim country, but the traditions of the indigenous Malays incorporated all the spirits. So it was natural to talk about that. It's a bit like the Tibetans, you know, they were trying to get rid of the Bon religion, and they were a bit brutal, I think. And yet they're into spirits on some level. They are into it. They didn't want me teaching about it at a local Buddhist centre, but I know they acknowledge it. It's just that it's not official.
Yes. Really, it's the most natural thing.
Yeah.
It's really only, I think, with really the industrial age, I think, really launched it, and certainly into the century.
Some people say it was the Iron Age. Everything went downhill in the Iron Age, because actually iron and metals, most metals, the fairies are upset by, because it has a interrupting effect on energy flows. So if you put a metal fence across where there's a fairy line, you've stopped the energy. That will then earth itself or go somewhere else. So you're blocking energy flows when you have metallic buildings and sheds and fences.
Victor Schauberger, I'm sure you know who Victor Schauberger was. He also discovered that later in his life when he designed farm equipment and also tools for gardening using copper, because he said the iron, bits of it would slough off and had a very deadening effect.
Yes. Has bad effect, yes. Yeah, so copper's not so bad. But I mean, I'll have to interview a nature spirit one day and see what they think about copper, but not as bad as iron anyway.
Yeah. Okay. Well,
yeah.
About, I mean, you can certainly use dowsing for finding water.
Mm.
And I spoke with a dowser a while back who can speak to wells. And if the well is dried, sometimes you can get the spirit of that well to. The water back. Have you had that experience?
Yeah, not personally, but I'm awestruck when I hear about people can do that. It's great. Yeah, I've heard about one dowser in Ireland. He just yelled down the well, you know, we want our water back, something like that, and it came back.
That's great. I love those stories.
yeah. But you know, we don't really know what's happening, do we? Because unless you can kind of X-ray vision, you can see, you know, it could be that the fairies are bringing the water back for all we know. Because I suspect that when there's traditions of healing, for instance, at a lot of holy wells or like Lourdes or somewhere, springs, famous, you know, healing springs, you know, for all we know, it could be nature spirits are involved with that work, or angels, or, you know, other dimensional beings are there because they feed off energy. So if it's a high energy spring, that's going to be an attractive place for them to be. And, you know, they may well be facilitating that healing as well as the water. So, you know, nobody knows exactly what it is. Some people who are chemists will say, oh, it's the germanium or something in the water. And then someone else will have a different perspective and say, oh, it's the energy of the water. Or, you know, everyone's got, because we have this way of compartmentalizing everything, I try and look holistically anyway. And, you know.
Well, so you spoke of the fairy as being nature spirits, and there are many, many different kinds of nature spirits. How would you, I don't want to use the word classify exactly, but how would you describe?
Yes, because you could say they're like the animal kingdom. They have different species. There's groups of related species. There'd be different species on mountains to ones in valleys to ones on rivers or forests or deserts. So this is why I try and avoid some of these names, because it's sort of like stereotyping. If I say elf, then you're going to think of a particular shaped thing, you know, and maybe it looks quite different to what I'm talking about. So I don't bother too much with those names. No. You know, I have one that lives under my kitchen. I have family of, I call them gnomes, but I don't know what they are. You know, I'm not into names, but I just know that he's very funny. He's hilarious. This chief, the chief of the gnomes, he's got very curly white beard, and he's very funny, because when I introduce myself to him, and I don't normally do this, but it was like, yeah, we'll do it because I'm moving into the house. It's just recent. He said, I'm the king, I'm the king. You know, that's typical. They'd like to feel important. They're just like people. Everyone likes attention. They like attention. I said, great, I'll call you king then. He said, oh, you call me Joe if you want. Oh, I said, okay, well, what about King Joe? And he said, no, joking, joking.
Oh my goodness, this is classic.
You must be joking.
That's great.
Yeah, he's got an amazing sense of humor.
Yes, well, they play with words, don't they?
They play with words, and I'd never thought of that word play myself, I must say. That was new to me. Anyway, he's a jolly, jolly old thing. And often when I go down to the kitchen, I don't know why, but I just feel like dancing. And then I think, oh, Joe King is around because he likes me to dance. It won't be music or anything. They love people to dance, and of course they love to dance. I'm not sure about gnomes, but see, I don't pry unless it's only, I have to have a good reason to communicate with them. In that case, I'm living on his land, and I need to make sure, you know, we're good together. And as I said, I don't want people bulldozing their homes or whatever. So in those cases, I'll communicate with them. Or they'll communicate with me, you know, on a basis, a needs basis, needs to know, yeah. And or they might come to me in dreams or whatever. But, like, that's why I have this sort of professional approach, because I don't want to be in fairyland the whole time. Actually, I've escaped 7 years of fairyland because I was 7 years on my farm, and I just moved into a village, and I got totally worn out from gardening. I was just constantly gardening. And then the previous book I wrote was all about all this food I produced and the quinoa and the vegetables and the fruit. And it was absolute paradise. I called the book Peasant in Paradise. And, but, you know, I didn't have a big family to feed or anything. And I've started to think, why am I doing this? It's not appreciated by the partner who I've left. And then I just had to get out, and I thought, oh, wow, I've just escaped 7 years from being under the thumb of those fairies up there. They wanted me in the garden all the time. They loved it. They loved all the attention I gave them, and they loved that I was doing something there that it had been abandoned for so long. And because there's a lot of depopulation and abandoned derelict houses, and mine was just a holiday house. It only had people 3 weeks every year, but, you know, long time. So, yeah, I'm able to write my books now. I've escaped from fairyland, but I still go back up there. But it's funny because I was so compelled to do this gardening. I think they must have been like twisting my arm somehow, you know. They made me do it. Now, I do love gardening, but I was doing too much.
Yeah.
With COVID as well. There was a lot of that in COVID.
What is that, where that story took place that you talk about in Fairy Haunts of Ireland, where with the tool there
Yes. Yes, exactly, where the tool just went snap.
Yes, could you share that story? Because that gets your attention. That's, you know.
I know, and I've just got the photo. I've still got the tool, the broken thing. I should frame it or something. Because I had a friend who I thought he knew about my fairy circle that I'd put a stone circle around. It was a vortex of earth energy where the fairies come and go, a portal. And we were close to it. We weren't that close. And he was helping me with some weeding or grass cutting. I had a new tool, and it was this very nice new German sickle for cutting grass. And it was only grass. He wasn't heating rocks or anything. But I had my back turned to him, and I must have just been a bit lax that I didn't warn him, like, don't go in there, just keep on this side. But anyway, I didn't say anything. Next thing I know, he says, "Oh, my thing just broke." So he'd strayed into the fairy circle, and immediately the sickle snapped in two, and it was like brand new tool. And there
from
was only
Germany.
yeah, from like really well made, properly made, not cheap, nasty thing. I thought, well, but actually, I didn't even know why I'd have done that, because I hadn't worked it out. And later I said, "Well, where were you when you did that?" "Oh, okay," I said, "okay, now I know why it happened. A fairy did it." But nevertheless, I sent it to the people who sold me. I sent them a photo, and they said, "Oh, we have never had that happen ever. It's never happened before. We'll send you another one." So I did get another one. Exactly.
I mean, it's like a microcosm of what you were talking about earlier about, okay, that's one example of what happens when you infringe on a boundary.
Yes. Yes. I'd even marked the boundary with the rocks, because they were covered in grass. So you didn't really see it. That was the thing. Probably didn't even know where he was, because it was all covered in grass. Because it's so fertile here, you just can't stop the grass growing. It's just like, I had 2 acres of weeds. I was going crazy trying to keep things in order. Not, I mean, I'm not a tidy town person, but just to keep the weeds out of the vegetables, it's good.
Yeah. Well, someone who wants to connect with the fairy, I think dowsing is a very good.
Yeah, it's a very good starting place, because you need to learn how to focus and concentrate. And then you put your intention to find whatever it is. So if you have the intention of finding a fairy and you've practiced the dowsing, you've got a very good chance that you can find it. And you have to get all those things into alignment. The power of your intentions, your ability to focus, emptying the mind, getting into the mind state, the slower thinking, the alpha waves predominating, even theta waves, and going to the places where there's a tradition of them being there, of course. So then you'll have a good opportunity. Because, like, I'm not looking for little ones, you know. I'm interested in the more evolved ones that are interested in bigger and more intelligent, and might be, their territory might be a big garden, or might be forest or a region. You know, those are the ones that really stand out. Whereas there's little ones everywhere, of course, tiny little flower ones. And yeah, there's plenty of tiny ones. But usually when we say fairies, we mean something that's a bit bigger than that. Yeah, maybe. Yeah.
What is your sense of the she?
She is just the nature spirits. Yeah.
Okay.
So that's just the Irish word for nature spirits. Yeah, but there's interesting word because if you say she, you could be referring to a hill that has a Neolithic monument on top, a mound. So a mound can also be called she, just as we have words in English that have many different diverse meanings. But in fact, these are related meanings. So traditionally, the Celtic tribes that came and inhabited Ireland, and they all spoke Gaelic, even though they're all different tribes, and they came big time in the Iron Age, like 2,000 years ago, roughly. They had the tradition of building a mound and a passage grave, well, not passage graves then, that was already done. But they maintained a tradition of the more ancient people that the ancestor, the bones of the ancestors would be placed inside the mound. So that became your ancestral place, just as we might go to a graveyard, you know, and all the families are there. This was in the form of a mound. And they didn't put bodies in, obviously they'd fill up. So they had a lot of death rituals and they'd end up with a bunch of charred bones and the bones would be deposited. And it might have just been important people or we don't know. They didn't leave records. So there's association with spirits and these mounds. And then often the mounds are on hilltops because that's where the people lived because it was so wet and boggy that they could only live on the hilltops. It has dried out since then, even though it is wet. There's been phases where it's been drier or wetter and hotter and colder, of course, throughout those thousands of years. But still, this tradition has been maintained for thousands of years of the she mounds. So then in the medieval stories, they talked about things that they made up. They said the Tuatha De Danann, which is not a tribe I've ever seen any other reference to except in medieval literature. So you could say it's just a term that's been adopted to represent those tribes at that time. That they had a fight with another tribe and they lost, so their spirits went into the mounds. Well, that's just actually just a reiteration of what was happening anyway for thousands of years, is that you would expect the spirits of your ancestors, not necessarily, not nature spirits, but there was also the tradition that the gods and goddesses, their homes were in the mounds. They had their own mounds. So you might have Lu's mound or Maeve's mound or whatever. So that's, you know, an old Celtic thing. So, yeah, if you say she, like we have She Moor and She Beg near me as this sacred hills in my area, and that was immortalized by a tune by a O'Carolan harpist guy. It's quite a well-known tune. And inspired by stories about fairies there. But so some people say, oh, it's a big fairy mountain, you know, which sounds very cute and everything, but actually it's got three Bronze Age tombs on top. And it probably really means the mountain with the ancestral tombs on top, which also has stories about fairies living in the caves. But if it didn't have those tombs on top, it wouldn't be called She Moor, you know, because it's a tomb type of hill. Yeah. And the other interesting thing, you know, there's lots of different names for hills. Tara is the name for a panoramic hill. So there are many Taras, and because of with the panoramic view, this is where the chieftains like to set up camp because they could see all around, see if the enemy was coming. And there was hundreds of kings at any given time, and they're all fighting each other. And so there are many Taras, which were capitals of different tribal areas. And the Tara of Meath, which is written about a lot, was actually just one of many Taras. Yeah. Whereas most people think Tara was very important. Well, it was in the Bronze Age, but not after that. There was a lot of fiddling around with the medieval stories according to the political wishes of the day, that they were pushing different agendas for different tribes. So it's very misleading, a lot of the so-called histories of Ireland, because they were altered a lot. In not everything, but certain things, they wanted it to rewrite history. So we call it pseudo history. So you get, yeah, you'll learn something from it, but don't take it at face value. But this is what I have to weigh up writing these books, because I think, I don't know if I believe that story. And then I'll look at the folklore of that particular area, and it'll have a often have a different slant again. So then I compare, and it's so interesting.
That's why I love what you were saying about really relying on the firsthand accounts from.
Yeah, exactly. Yeah.
They were so in touch. That's why I really love the fairy faith in Celtic countries. I think that is such
that's a great book. Yeah, because that was him getting the stories firsthand from the people whose, you know, cousin saw the thing or whatever, them. Yeah, it's brilliant. Yeah, W.B. Yeats, of course, is an inspiration. He was friends with Evans Wentz, and that's why they were always around Sligo, which is the coastal area near me. It's about an hour's drive from me, and there's some incredible megalithic areas just all over the place. It's an amazing island because there's so few places in Europe that became and stayed depopulated probably since the famine. You know, the population was maybe double. And it meant that they weren't going around wiping out all these old monuments to put the new things on because there's nobody there. And it's preserved so much. Plus the respect or the fear of disturbing things. You know, it's like, oh, we can't touch that big stone megalith. The fairies won't like that. Or we can't touch that ring fort. And that was a very strong belief. And that's why we can still see the things in the environment. Not modern people. I mean, in some areas near Dublin, you won't see anything. I remember flying, we were delayed when I was flying into Dublin once. We had to do a few circuits around the countryside near Dublin. I could not see any of those features. We were not high above the ground in the plane. Couldn't see any of those features that I see here, tucked away in a very quiet rural backwater where it's so-called poor land. So they didn't have, they didn't bulldoze things away like they do here. You know, we have hedgerows everywhere. Mm-hmm.
There are fairly modern stories too. There was, I think, one recently, wasn't there, where some man wanted to build, I don't know, a building or something over a fairy fort, and didn't he have to bring people out in from the outside to build it because locals wouldn't do it for him, and it was built, and then I think he lost his fort. I can't remember who.
Something happened to him.
Yeah.
I'm sure there's a lot of stories, and they continue to this day. So it's, you know, it's a never-ending thing because it's something in the back of people's minds, but more the country people, not the city people, of course. Yeah.
And I would think of that also as the spirit of that place being very strong. Very, you know, that's a strong spirit that can activate that.
Well, two-way thing, yeah, it's a strong belief system. I think, you know, the people here are very connected to the places. Every single field would have a name on a farm, you know, and multi-generations. This is something unusual for me, coming from Australia, where people are moving around all the time. They're very, or maybe on farms, you might get that, but I didn't see it in my life there. But here, it's like every farm has been in the same family for many, many generations. And you go in their houses and they're just full of ancestral spirits. It's like, it's full. It's like old granny there and whatever. Yeah. But it's sort of weird farming because they rely on subsidies. They all have day jobs, you know. It's not productive farming, you might say.
Yeah, so much has changed.
Just a couple of cows and can't make any money, but you get subsidies from the EU.
So the fairy, though, you spoke of this earlier, touched on this. They're a mixture of ancestors as well, it sounds like.
The fairy world.
Yeah, and the fairy world. That it would be
people. Well, there might be. No, the reason why you'd see the ancestral spirits in a house is because they love the family so much that they want to hang around. Some of them are. They want to care and continue caring for their family members because they love them. Other ones might have emotional problems and need healing. Mm. That's what I'd be more used to, coming into a place where someone said, "Oh, there's a nasty spirit," and I'll try and tune in and pick up on their pain or whatever they have that's preventing them from moving on to the next phase, whatever that is.
And then
And
what do you?
I call for angelic help usually, but I offer them healing, and I say, "Well, I feel sorry for you. I've sympathized, whatever," and you acknowledge that that's how they're feeling. There was a woman spirit in my farm up the road. Farm, it's only 2 acres. And I think she might have died in the famine, a horrible death of starvation. She could have even killed herself. Often they did, because it's a horrible death, so you might try and speed it up, imagine. But then, of course, you'd have the huge guilt in the Catholicism if you killed yourself. You'd be a total baddie if you did that. So you imagine the layers of guilt and awful emotional distress a person like that would be in. And it was actually where the polytunnel is that I put next to my house, a little old cottage. And there had been another little old cottage next to it previously when it was highly populated. And that's why every time I went in to set up the garden and dig the weeds out, oh, I'd get exhausted, I'd get exasperated, and I got depressed. And I'd never been depressed gardening before. It usually has the other effect of feeling down, it'll lift you up. And eventually I thought, I bought this house unseen. The husband at the time was an architect. I was in Australia, and it was just in a good spot. And he looked at it anyway. He said it was all right. But I did the map dowsing. So that's what I like doing now, is not running around physically anymore, but actually getting people to send me a map. Then I pick up on the energies from a distance by dowsing and give them some advice. So I'd done that for myself, and I'd worked out that it was okay, but there was a spirit of a person hanging around. But I'd forgotten that. And then I was so, having encountered the spirit, I remembered finally, because it took a long time to buy it. And I thought, oh, okay. And as soon as I had that thought, that intention, then I could see this woman in rags, very sad. So said to the husband and his friend there, "Oh, we'll have to have a ceremony." So one guy playing the flute, I had some bells, we created a ceremony. And as we did it and acknowledged the presence of this woman, oh, the tears just started to pour out of our eyes, just crying, pouring down our cheeks. And we acknowledged the pain of this woman and sent her on her way. And then I never had any problem gardening there ever again. I was quite happy to do the gardening, and she was gone. But somehow she needed to have someone just recognizing, and I don't know, maybe the angels sent some healing to her. I just don't know, but it's good now, and that's the main thing.
So I would think there would be great swaths of land in parts of Ireland where, I mean, I really see that as that was a genocide, that what do they call
Yes.
it on Gough Moor, the Great Hunger? I would think there would be swaths of land where, because of course, great areas where people were just
Well,
starving.
people were just dying on the streets. There was bodies everywhere, and they just sort of throw something over them, and they didn't have the strength to bury them, or they didn't know who they were or whatever. Yeah, it would have been horrific, especially when they had food in the shops, and if you had money, you could buy food. That was even the worst thing. It wasn't actually a natural famine at all. It was
No.
a kind of form of genocide, is withholding food from people, as is happening in Gaza at the moment.
That's right.
Genocide, yeah.
So, do you
And
ever?
their culture also was genocided by Christianity. So, yeah.
Do you work with large swaths of land ever to?
No, I tend to just do more backyard stuff, people's properties and things.
Okay.
Yeah.
So, for someone who is sensing that there is, we'll just say, imbalanced energy on their property or in their home, so they could use dowsing to get maybe some answers.
They
And
could, but the problem with doing your own place is that you tend to not want to find anything bad. So that can create a blockage to seeing if there is something bad, because you only want it to be good. This is why it's better to get someone who you don't know, who has no idea about your place. They're totally blank and they have no opinions about it. And so I say to people, look, if you send me a map or if I'm going to your place, don't tell me anything. Just tell me where the boundary is or whatever, where I need to look, you know, what's important to you, I'll look there. And then we'll swap notes about what you think it is or what happened, or, and usually there's concurrence. But if they were to tell me an elaborate story about what they thought, you know, that could infect my mind and somehow warp my impartial dowsing ability. Yeah. So get your friends to do it, or better, even strangers to do it for you if you can.
Well, I actually gave your name to a good friend of mine. I mean, she has no problems or issues on her land, but she wanted to have it doused, and I think she's contacted you. So,
Yeah, well, very occasionally people have good energy and want me to find that out, but usually it's not very nice energy. So, but I love doing fairy head counts. I could potentially, you know, even though they move around, you know, they might have their territory and their stations, you know, where they are. That's the sort of thing I like to do, because it's more fun than finding out about the horrible, sad Sikh energies or the dreadful place where I was dowsing in the west of Ireland in Mayo, where the guy used to get beaten up by the spirits at night in his bed, physically, somehow beaten up. And he was like, you know, he was like an intelligent guy who was a retired acupuncturist or something. And it was a long trip to get there, but I just knew I had to go and help him, because normally I'd say, oh, no, you're too far away and my stupid electric car won't go that far and there's no public charges, whatever. And, I found that his bed was coincident with geopathic stress, which is what happens when you have energy lines. And also the place was full of spirits from the Civil War from 100 years ago, and they didn't know the war was over and they were still fighting each other. Yeah. So there was soldier spirits there, and that's why they were fighting. And I had to gently, respectfully, lovingly move them on. Because you can't just say, get out. You know, this is what I've learned, is that you have to apply compassion, because there's reasons for them hanging around and they probably didn't know that peace had been declared or whatever. So they've moved on now, and that guy sleeps sweetly and has not had a problem. I've had to also do earth acupuncture, and I can't remember now, it was a few years ago. But that was the most extreme spirit problem case of one of them I've come across. Yeah.
When you say they've moved on, do they get essentially maybe sent, quote unquote, home, or just to a different?
I have no idea. I just usually enlist angelic help.
Right. So they're in good hands.
I trust in the energies that they will go to where they need to go in the next step. Yeah. See, I have no religious framework in my upbringing. So I just keep it. I don't have any opinions of how what's supposed to happen. So it means I'm more open-minded, is what I'm saying. You know, just whatever happens, and I've learned to trust.
Yes.
And you get feedback from people. And I think it's the sort of job where, yeah, you can't give a guarantee or anything, but if you didn't get good results, you wouldn't get invited to do more work. You know, it's like word of mouth.
Yes.
Like I have a friend staying here, and she's saying, oh, well, have you got a business card? No. I would feel like a failure if I had a business card, because it's more of a sort of job where you get it from word of mouth. Yeah.
Yeah, yeah, that feels much more organic. And
like recommendations. Yeah.
Yeah. Yes. Mm. Well, we are at the end of the first hour, so we'll come back.
That's great. Yeah.
And when we have the second hour, I would love for you to talk to geopathic stress, and we'll get into all of that in that time. So for people who want to contact you, your website is geomantica.com.
Correct.
And someone wants you to map dowse for them. Do you want to give an email for people to, or do they just go to the website?
You'll find the email. It's just info@geomantica.com. But yeah, you'll find it on the site. Yeah.
Okay. Wonderful.
Yeah. Great.